A very good morning to everyone. The first case on the docket for this morning's oral argument is number 013715 and following, the United States against Miguel Quintanilla and et al. And we'll hear first from Mr. Brinkmeyer.
Good morning. To please the court, Mr. Blackington for the United States government, Ms. Korn, my colleague, and Mr. Shaw. My name is Dennis Brinkmeyer, and I represent Alfredo Ceballos. The first issue that is before the court for the appellant's brief concerns the district court's ruling to allow DEA agents to testify as expert witnesses concerning drug code language. During the course of this investigation, wiretaps were obtained, and there were some 20 telephone conversations that were heard by various representatives of the DEA, as well as interpreters who listened to these particular conversations. And the conversations were in many cases in the Spanish language. The interpreters were employed for the purpose of translating the Spanish into the English, and then at trial, two DEA agents testified as to what they believed the meaning of these telephone conversations were.
There was no real question as to the accuracy of the interpretation.
Your Honor, that was a question that was before the court, was as to whether or not these tapes were accurately transcribed. And what we had argued at the trial court was the fact that there are many dialects in the Spanish language. Some of these people were from Texas, other people were from Mexico, and we challenged the accuracy of that translation. And then what the court ruled was is that the drug code language, which certainly we recognize that there is case law to support witnesses testifying as to drug code language, the objection went to the fact that there were these conversations which were translated, and then the officer or the agent testified in court what he thought, what the meaning of those conversations were.
I got that. My question was, what evidence was there that the translations were imperfect?
Your Honor,
there are 150 Spanish dialects that they discuss regularly in the language itself. I wondered whether that many words are precisely the same in all 150 dialects.
That was the problem that I thought that we had, was because it was impossible for us to be able to know the accuracy of what the conversations were. The witnesses testified that the interpreters testified that they listened to these tapes, translated them to English, and in doing so, then the agents testified as to what their meaning was. But we certainly believe that these tapes may be inaccurate and they may not be reliable.
Is there anything in the record indicating that they are inaccurate?
Your Honor, there probably isn't anything that is in the record that
say. There isn't?
That there probably isn't anything in the record.
Is not.
But right, certainly we were unable to attack that because the court ruled that these interpreters, that the conversations were transcribed, were accurate. And we had no way of disproving that, sir.
All right. So there's nothing in the record to demonstrate the inaccuracy. So go on with the argument.
All right. And that is the basis that in setting out the objection under Federal Rule 702 that sets the standard concerning the admissibility of that particular evidence. Specialized knowledge can help the trier of the fact to understand evidence if the witness has applied principle and methods reliable to the facts of the case, and that's exactly what Your Honor is asking in terms of the question. We certainly believe that because the agents relying on what the testimony was, we believed that it was sort of a jump for them to say that this is accurate, and therefore the meaning of this conversation is that it's drug code language. Also, in the brief that has been submitted to the court, the basis for the discussion of certain words, pronouns, which were it, them, whatever, there was given meaning to particular words or pronouns that was identified by the agents as meaning methamphetamine. And we believe that that ruling is contrary to Rule 702 as well, and there is case law that supports the fact that those types of words should be given their common meaning. And I would cite to the court the case of Sanchez versus Galvez, which stated that under Rule 702, that the witness has to be qualified, that the witness does not speak to matters that are within the knowledge and experience of the jury. And that was for the jury to determine whether or not the meaning of it, them, or I can recall words like cars or girls had anything to do with methamphetamine. And we believe that the court erred.
Were you the trial counsel?
I was, Your Honor.
Did you argue that to the jury?
Yes, we did argue that to the jury, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes.
The government cites a case, United States versus Vega, in which they say it, as code language for drugs, was there was permitted to come in.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Vega, United States versus Vega, the government cites it in their brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
You believe it does not state that? But you know, you can testify about pronouns meaning drugs?
Your Honor, I certainly believe that that in this particular situation, the problem centered on the fact that there was a great deal of reliability on what these agents testified to as far as an expert opinion. I know that agents can testify in order to identify what drug code language is. However, in this particular case, and this is our argument, is that these particular agents were not trained in decoding certain language. They testified that they had had some experience as agents in the field, but we felt that under the circumstances that because these languages or these conversations were in Spanish and translated into English, that it was certainly more, I think, than what the other cases have been decided previously concerning drug code language. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we believe that the court abused its discretion in allowing that particular testimony.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from the court.
May it please the court. My name is Beverly Corn, and in the trial, I represented Miguel Quintanilla. My topic that I am discussing is the wiretaps. When the Congress passed Title III, they set up certain safety nets regarding how the government should go around setting up and applying for wiretaps. When the government follows all of these safety nets, then everything moves quite smoothly. No person's rights are violated. However, in this particular case, we believe, and we believe that in the trial we dealt with this issue, and the trial court ruled that the safety nets were not violated. It is our position that the government failed to prove necessity, failed to get the proper authority under the Texas wiretap. And in so doing, they did not follow the safety nets that Congress had set up. Regarding necessity, the agents testified in their affidavits that they had conducted surveillance, that they had been able to get 10 registers, that they knew a lot of the parties who were involved, and that because of that, they were able to set up confidential informants and have hand-to-hand buys. But in spite of all of that, they said, we need to have the wiretap information. I know that this court has said that it's a common sense and a practical matter analysis in determining whether or not necessity has been met. But when you look at all of that, when you look at the evidence that was adduced, how can it be said that they needed the wiretap? It's our belief and it's our contention that this need was nothing more than greed. They had a lot of the evidence that they needed in order to get search warrants, in order to follow the normal routine and the normal practice of their investigations. However, they weren't satisfied with following the normal procedures. So they went to the court and they said, we need to get these wiretaps. In Texas, there were two different wiretaps. One was set up in Indiana. One was set up also in Texas. In the Texas wiretaps, they went to the court and they said, we've had electronic surveillance. We've been able, we know, we've talked to people who have been allegedly dealing drugs with these people for many years. And so they had a lot of this information. But again, they needed the wiretaps. It is our belief that they overstepped the boundaries, the safety nets that were set up by Congress. Also in the Texas wiretap application, we have contended that they did not have the proper approval. That goes to looking at who signed the request and presented it to the judge. In the appendixes, there are the applications and the exhibits that were attached to them. In one of the exhibits, it's purportedly a letter from the assistant U.S. attorney or the U.S. attorney for that district, although it's not signed by that U.S. attorney. It is signed by someone whose name was Mary Warren. Mary Warren conceivably is a deputy U.S. attorney or an assistant under that U.S. attorney. Do we know that? No, we don't. We also know that in United States versus Giordano, that the United States Supreme Court says that you cannot overstep that particular boundary, that particular safety net. That cannot be delegated. A U.S. attorney cannot delegate to, in that particular case, it was an executive assistant. It must, the proper person must be the person who signs the request for the applications. And the United States Supreme Court also said that that is a very strict, I'm paraphrasing, but that is a very strict procedure that must be followed. And because of these deficiencies that we believe that the government failed in their applications for wiretaps. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Corn. We now have Mr. Shaw on the telephone, I believe. Mr. Shaw?
Money from the sale of methamphetamine. There's no evidence to show that the methamphetamine was acquired from the Moreno source. It was connected by the source end of the conspiracy to the charge conspiracy. In fact, if you look at the record, and what the government cited in its brief is supporting its assertion, those facts show that the methamphetamine last delivery was on May 12th, and that methamphetamine was paid for on May 15th, and the 194 and 195 for 3 days went May 18th, and there's no connection between that money and the methamphetamine that was acquired from Moreno. During the arguments concerning the admissibility of these citizens in the government brief, the government argues that there's a common purpose. Well, all methamphetamine conspiracies have a common purpose. They are methamphetamine. The agreement that you and I will sell methamphetamine has the same purpose as the agreement between some California civil defense attorney and some Ninth Circuit judge to sell methamphetamine. Just because we have a common purpose doesn't mean, or the same purpose or a similar purpose, doesn't mean that it's the same conspiracy. Again, another example, I'm a partner with you in a clothing store in Chicago. The evidence shows that I run a clothing store in Dallas. That evidence proves that you're my partner in the clothing store in Dallas, or that you're involved in any way in the clothing store in Dallas. And I think the answer is no. There is no evidence to show that the conversations involving Sony 194 and 195 are linked to the charge of conspiracy. In regard to the other issue that the raises in her brief, in regard to the filing of the 851 notice, and in a civil lawsuit for jurisdiction that requires actual delivery that does complaint under Rule 4E is necessary for the court to acquire jurisdiction. It doesn't matter if prior to the filing of the complaint that there's been conversations between the parties that, well, if you don't do this, you don't pay me that, I'm going to sue you. But it doesn't matter whether there's conversations between I and government as to whether or not.
Well, it was more than that in this case, wasn't it? I mean, you were told, were you not, before the commencement of trial, that the government would seek the additional penalty?
Yes, and just like the example I just gave, I could have been told that I'm going to sue you if you don't do what I want. And
well, there was no condition, was there, on the government statement at that point? They told you they had filed. Well, what did the government tell you, sir, Mr. Shaw, if I may? What did the government tell you? Did the government tell you they had filed it, or that they were going to file it, or did they place any condition on their filing it?
They told me that they would file it if there wasn't a plea prior to trial. They told me that they did file it.
They told you they...
the day before the trial started.
And you simply had not received the copy in your office yet via the postal service, is that right?
That's correct. We did not receive the copy until 3 days after the trial.
So your argument is that because this is jurisdictional, telling you about it wasn't sufficient. You hadn't been served.
That is exactly correct. Just like if I were to tell you I filed a lawsuit against you, that doesn't accomplish delivery under Rule 40.
Now, we follow the rule, or have up to this time followed the rule, that that service is jurisdictional. That's not a unanimous view of the circuits. Why does our position make sense? Does the court really obtain jurisdiction over a defendant because of this, because of service in this case, or is it simply notification of a particular step in the proceedings? What phraseology in the statute do you rely upon to prove that it's jurisdictional in nature? That would certainly would argue that we ought to require strict compliance with the statute, but does that imply that we ought to treat it as a jurisdictional issue? Thank you, Mr. Shaw. And we'll hear now from Mr. Blackington.
May it please the court, my name is Brad Blackington. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of Indiana. Before responding to the arguments that my opposing counsel have made, I wanted to first draw attention to some of the issues raised in the response to my cross-appeal issue that was filed by defendants Alfredo Ceballos and Alan Martinez Guzman. And these are the two issues. The first issue is what the appropriate standard of review should be when addressing the issue of the sentencing enhancement for use of a minor. In my brief, I argue it's a de novo standard because we're dealing with a question of law and how that particular sentencing provision has been interpreted. My opponent's brief, they refer to it as an abuse of discretion standard. We believe it's a de novo standard because we're dealing with a question of law rather than a question of fact, and the issue of whether the judge properly interpreted the law regarding that issue. Secondly, I would take issue with the parts in their brief where they allege that there was no factual finding that Mr. Martinez Guzman and Alfredo Ceballos used a minor in furtherance of the drug trafficking activity. In my brief, I pointed to specific sections in the sentencing hearings for both defendants in which the court did say that he found that both defendants used a minor in furtherance of the drug trafficking activity. So I think we're really dealing with a straight question of law here and whether the district court properly interpreted the law, and so a de novo statute's appropriate. Referring to the arguments that my opposing counsel made earlier, first of all, concerning the code language, this court asked Mr. Brinkmeyer several questions about the accuracy of the translations. And just to draw out the facts a bit that are in the record from prior hearings, the court did not make a ruling that the transcripts were accurate and that the translations were accurate. What the court ruled was this, that the government had provided all of the defense counsel with copies of the tapes many months before trial, had provided the defense counsel with the transcripts approximately a month before trial, and that the defense attorneys had the opportunity to take the transcripts and the tapes to their own expert witness who spoke Spanish in order to obtain a separate defense translation.
Wouldn't even have to be an expert, simply an interpreter.
That's correct, Your Honor. It would not have to be an expert, just an interpreter. And in fact, one of the defense attorneys in this case was brought out in the record, spoke fluent Spanish. So the court looked at that and the fact that there wasn't any type of alternative transcript and ruled the transcripts admissible and allowed the expert witnesses, Agent Styron and Agent Kress, to base their testimony in those translations. And dealing with the issues of the pronouns, in my brief I drew attention to one specific telephone call. It was call number 74, in which the pronoun that was used. And the court can look at the use of the word that and see where the government was and where the expert witnesses were basing their opinion. They're talking about the delivery of that. There are no nouns preceding that use of the word that to which the speakers could be referring. They're not talking about, fried chicken or food or any specific noun. It's simply a reference that drops out of the sky to let's deliver that. So it became clear to these agents, particularly when they placed that call in the context of other telephone calls and a one-pound seizure of methamphetamine and language from prior recorded calls during controlled drug transactions, that the word that was code language and a reference to methamphetamine. And that was the basis for the testimony, the expert testimony throughout. Moving ahead to the wiretap issues and the necessity issue, in as far as the Indiana wiretaps went, prior to the application for wire surveillance in this case, DEA had in fact executed a number of controlled buys from lower level people in the enterprise. Mr. Guzman, Jorge Hernandez Martinez, Abelardo Mendoza. They'd done some controlled buys from those people, but they didn't know who the source of the methamphetamine was. And on one call in March, on one undercover meeting on March 3rd of 2000, the lower level traffickers show up at the informant's residence and they show up without the methamphetamine. The informant and an undercover officer asked them where the methamphetamine is, and they say, in essence, we didn't know we were supposed to bring methamphetamine, but we're going to go back to our person to see if we get you some. They go back to their residence. They use the residential phone where there's a pen register active on the residential phone. They call a pager, which becomes target pager one in the wiretap, and they receive an incoming telephone call for what's target phone two in the wiretap, which is in fact Alfredo Ceballos' phone. As of March 3rd and the date the DEA applied for the wiretap, they had no idea who Alfredo Ceballos was. They had no idea who was using Target Pager 1 or Target Phone 2. And the wiretap was generated to identify who that source was, who was using those communication devices, and who the source of methamphetamine was for these lower-level distributors that were coming to the informant's residence. That, in essence, and we can put aside a lot of the other issues, yes, they tried surveillance, they tried pen registers, as I mentioned, they tried undercover agents. Every other recognized alternative law enforcement source was discussed in the wiretap affidavit, but that, in essence, was the necessity for the wiretap. Similarly, in Texas, their necessity was this. Okay, Indiana, through their wiretap surveillance, has identified Miguel Cantania as the source of methamphetamine for the people in Indiana. But we don't know who Miguel Cantania's source is. So with that in mind, and they've done all of this, they've tried surveillance, other forms of law enforcement activity, but that, in essence, is a necessity for their application to move up the chain and identify higher-level dealers, which they did. The authority for the wire surveillance. Mary Lee Warren isn't a deputy United States attorney, as Ms. Korn had said. If you look at the document, it says she's a deputy assistant attorney general. She has authority under the Janet Reno's order at the time, Attorney General Reno, to authorize applications for wire surveillance. Her name and title are right on the authorizing document. The district court made the finding that that's who she is, and she made she had the authority to authorize the application. So I see that as fairly clear cut as well. The last issue I'd like to address are the wiretap conversations that Mr. Shaw's discussed. He's alleging that they're not connected to the charged conspiracy. Well, the conspiracy, as charged, doesn't just encompass acts occurring in southern Indiana. The specific language of the conspiracy charged the defendants with conspiring to commit offenses in the Southern District of Indiana and elsewhere. There is a lot of reference during the trial to activities Miguel Cantania and occasionally Denise helping him package methamphetamine in Texas, giving it to a drug courier and bringing him here. And these calls that Mr. Shaw is referring to are simple acts of distributing drugs and collecting drug proceeds from people in Dallas. And it's methamphetamine that was being distributed by Miguel Cantania and that came from Leonel Moreno. When you look at prior conversations, you can infer that the drugs came from Leonel Moreno, as the agents did. Now, Mr. Shaw says, well, in his argument today, says, well, the drugs are obtained May 12th or May 15th, and then the money's returned in May 18th. That's 6 days later. That's how the drug business works, as this court's aware from experience and reviewing this type of testimony numerous times. The drugs are received on the front by somebody. Someone like Leonel Moreno fronts drugs to a Miguel Cantania. Miguel Cantania, in turn, fronts out drugs to his distributors who sell the drugs, pay him the drugs, and then a period of time later, be it 3 days, 6 days, return the money to him. And there are no other sources of methamphetamine for Miguel Cantania that the defense attorneys can point to, other than Mr. Moreno in this case. And the deal occurred, be it 3 days or 6 days earlier, and, you know, here they are paying Denise Cantania back for the money on the 18th. So I think all of this, it's very clear. We have the same basic participants in the the transactions, Mr. Moreno, Miguel Cantanilla, Denise Cantanilla, they're the same as the people who are involved in providing the methamphetamine to Indiana, same people, same conspiracy. So I don't think that we can really say there are two separate conspiracies. And with that, and asking the court again, there wasn't any real argument by my opponents on it, but noting the cross-appeal issue of the use of the minor, I think that's fleshed out pretty well in the briefs, but unless the court has any questions for me, I don't have anything else to add.
Mr. Blackington, I'd like to ask you about this matter of the 851 sentence enhancement. What is your version of the facts? This thing, I gather the notice was actually mailed before trial but not received by counsel, am I correct?
I, of course, can't tell when Mr. Shaw reviewed it. I trust him, and I'll take no quarrel with his argument that it was received several days later. But what I'd like to tell the court, there's a little bit more in the record than what Mr. Shaw discussed. I didn't file this 851 information late out of laziness or sloth. As the district court found, and Mr. Shaw would agree with, we were involved in plea negotiations up till shortly before trial, in which Mr. Shaw was trying to get a sentence of less than life imprisonment for his client. If I would have filed that 851 information 6 months or a month before the trial, alleging two or more prior felony convictions, that would have been impossible. There would have been a mandatory life sentence. And in the appendix to my brief are letters to Mr. Shaw explaining that you know, if your client doesn't plead by such and such a date, I'm going to file these informations.
But his argument, sir, is that is exactly to prevent any ambiguity with respect to that sort of I don't want to use threats to potent a word to use, but just saying, but if you want a stance by the United States Attorney's Office during plea negotiations, to prevent any ambiguity between that situation and your definitively telling him that it's that you file it, the law requires that there be service, and then he knows for sure what his client faces. There's no ambiguity in the situation. Now, at any time before trial, did you definitively tell him that it had been filed?
Yes, I did. We had a pre-trial conference before the trial, and I told him it had been filed, and that's what the judge found as a finding of fact.
So your view is, at that point, he could have, in effect, gone down to the clerk's office and asked for a copy?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And just to draw out what Mr. Shaw is talking about with the being able to tell his client, here's the decision you have to make. Well, once the government files that 851 information, there's no decision left to make. It's mandatory life.
Now, are you taking the position then that the filing of this paper is in fact jurisdictional?
No, Your Honor. I think that it...
You don't seem in your brief to ask us to reconsider our cases in that respect.
No, Your Honor. I think
although the government has taken that position in other circuits,
I think that the court can find as a matter of law that actual notice is sufficient.
Usually would not be sufficient to get jurisdiction, though. Usually you'd have to serve a person to get jurisdiction. Simply verbal notification wouldn't be enough, right?
I understand your point, and if the court has ruled differently in that regard, we would ask it to reconsider its prior opinions. But I didn't see anything, any prior opinions before the Seventh Circuit dealing specifically with the 851 issue that ruled one way or the other.
And we have several. In fact, one judge of this court has taken issue with them. That's why I raised the point. We have definitively said three times at least that this is jurisdictional. And it's not a unanimous view, and the Department of Justice has taken the opposite view in some circuits.
We would do that here, and also the question is the district court really raised, when does service take place? Is it when you put it in the mail, or is it when it's received? And I noted a couple cases outside of this circuit where other circuit courts have said the service is complete when you put
but
it.
Those are circuits that have not said it's jurisdictional.
That's correct. So I would take the position here that it isn't jurisdictional for that reason. But I think in this particular circumstance, you have a situation where, yes, they do have actual notice of the filing of the indictment. And in this case particularly, the information wasn't filed until the last minute because of specific plea negotiations and requests by the defense counsel not to do that. So for them to come back later, especially when the trials conclude, and say, oh, you didn't follow these procedures, we didn't have notice, I have a problem with that. And I really think this isn't the type of case. I think but for those negotiations, if the defense attorney gets the 851 information late, does not have notice of what's in it until after the trial started, then the government has a big problem on appeal. But I think in this particular case, since the defense attorney does have actual notice, as you've pointed out, Your Honor, all he has to do is walk down to the clerk of court, get a copy of the document if he wants to show it to his client. I think that's sufficient.
Your position also here is irrevocable and mandatory. Is that it?
The filing of the information?
Yeah.
Largely, I suppose you could go back and you could get authority to withdraw an information, but in our offices and our office's procedures, and I don't know if they're Washington-based procedures or Indianapolis-based, Your Honor, you have to get the written authority of the U.S. attorney to do that. So if you're looking to do that right on the eve of trial, it's a very difficult thing to do.
But as far as the court is concerned, there'd be no reason why the government could not withdraw it.
I suppose it could if it followed the procedures.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Blackman.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
And I believe that, Mr. Brinkmeyer, you had reserved some time for rebuttal. You have 2 minutes, the clerk informs me.
Please, the court, I'd like to respond to Mr. Blackington's position concerning the sentencing of my client, Alfredo Ceballos, and the client, Martinez Guzman. At the sentencing hearing, the district court judge ruled that under 3B1.4, a two-level enhancement was not appropriate. The court, in sentencing both Mr. Ceballos as well as Mr. Guzman, had stated his reason for not imposing the two-level enhancement, saying that it was the court's position that that was only appropriate if the minor had been used in some way to protect or to conceal the identity of the defendant. And we believe that the court was correct in that the court should not have imposed that two-level enhancement. Relying on the United States versus Ramsey, this court's held that enhancement under 3B1.4, the relevant inquiry is whether the defendant took affirmative action to involve a minor in the commission of the offense. The court stated both in the sentencing of Mr. Ceballos as well as Mr. Martinez that a minor had been used. However, I don't believe that the court found that there in any way was any affirmative act on the part of Mr. Ceballos or Mr. Guzman that affirmatively involved the responsibility of employing the minor in the conspiracy. I think that the record indicated that there were a couple of times perhaps when
Hernandez-Martinez, who was the minor, was used in the purpose of translating from English into Spanish, but there was, in the court's opinion, there was no evidence that he had done anything affirmatively to have this minor involved in the conspiracy. And for that reason, we believe that the sentencing of both Mr. Ceballos as well as Mr. Guzman was appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Blackington.
Thank you.
Mr. Hartzler, Mr. Brinkmeyer.
Thank you.
Mr. Shaw, I believe that you have reserved some time for rebuttal as well. You have, I'm told, 6 minutes. Thank you, Mr. Shaw. First of all, the court would like to thank all counsel in the case for their very fine submission.